Here it is.
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, from New Orleans, Louisiana, where we're just finding out that the gold standard for ethics reform has been undermined by the insertion of three crucial words into the law, which is being bragged about all over the country, including on The Tonight Show. Jay, you might want to look into this, that any ethics question has to be resolved by the provision of, quote, clear and convincing evidence, which is higher than the standard under which O.J. Simpson was found liable for the two killings in the civil trial. Just one notch below beyond a reasonable doubt, and a standard of proof which an ethics board is unable to determine because it doesn't have prosecutors and investigators and blah, blah, blah. Hello. From the Buried Lead Department, this is from the new book by General Ricardo Sanchez. Name may ring a distant, fuzzy bell. He was the commander of U.S. troops in Iraq during the good times, back in Abu Ghraib days, when, you know, it was cool to pile prisoners in a naked human pyramid and send some snaps back home to the folks. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the real surge is beginning. The surge of books by people who've left and want to tell their version of the story. Already we've had Paul Wolfowitz's book and Doug Feith's book. Now here comes Ricardo Sanchez's book as the surge continues. And this is from Time Magazine's website's coverage excerpt from the book. Dig where the lead comes. Dig where the money sentence comes. So here's Ricardo Sanchez, ticked off because then Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, I told you this was the good old days, has called Sanchez in to read and review a memo that Rumsfeld has had generated that kind of makes it clear that whatever got screwed up, Rumsfeld didn't know about it. Specifically, the decision to start pulling American troops out of Iraq right after the toppling of the statue and of the guy the statue was depicting. So here's Sanchez. I'd never seen any approved CENTCOM, that's Central Command, campaign plan, either conceptual or detailed, for the post-major combat operations phase, the phase that's called Phase 4 in the military. When I was on the ground in Iraq and saw what was going on, I assumed they'd done zero Phase 4 planning. Now, 3 years later, I was learning for the first time my assumption was not completely accurate. In fact, CENTCOM had originally called for 12 to 18 months of Phase 4 activity with active troop deployments. But then, Sanchez continues, CENTCOM had completely walked away by simply stating the war was over and Phase 4 was not their job. That decision set up the United States for a failed first year in Iraq. The year Sanchez was there. There's no question about it. And I was supposed to believe that neither the Secretary of Defense knew anything about it? Impossible. Rumsfeld knew about it. Everybody in the NSC knew about it, including Condoleezza Rice, George Tenet, and Colin Powell. Vice President Cheney knew about it, and President Bush knew about it, says Sanchez. There's not a doubt in my mind that they all embraced this decision to some degree, the decision to pull the troops out when the war was declared over. And if it had not been for the moral courage of General John Abizaid to stand up to them all and reverse the troop withdrawal order, there's no telling how much more damage would have been done. In the meantime, hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars were unnecessarily spent, and worse yet, too many of our most precious military resource, American soldiers, were unnecessarily wounded, maimed, and killed as a result. The last sentence, ladies and gentlemen, in the article, the excerpt, quote, General Sanchez, in my mind, this action by the Bush administration amounts to gross incompetence and dereliction of duty, unquote. You just have to get to the end to read that, don't you? With a farewell to Al Wilson, hello, welcome to the show.
smile till you came into my life. And these are the arms that long to lock you inside every day and every night. Girl, and here is the soul of which you've taken control. Can't you see I'm trying to show love is right? Anywhere inside.
Anywhere inside.
And these are the lips that can't help calling your name in the middle of the night.
Middle of the night.
Oh, and here is the man who needs to know where you stand. Don't you know I've done all I can? So decide.
From spitting distance from the Mississippi River in New Orleans, Louisiana, from the French Quarter, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And ladies and gentlemen, the inspectors general have been at it again. A new report now warns that traveling through Yosemite, specifically the 74-year-old tunnel to see the views of the Granite Peaks, might literally take your breath away. Carbon monoxide can accumulate to hazardous levels in the busy summer months because aging tunnel fans don't work properly. Some experts also fear a disastrous fire could ignite. This is just one of several dozen safety hazards in dire need of repair, according to the Interior Department's Inspector General, who found risky conditions at work sites, schools, dams, and four popular national parks. Auditors said they also found a pattern of department managers repeatedly putting off fixes for longstanding public problems, longstanding safety problems that threaten both the public and employees. We believe the department must take immediate steps to prevent existing hazards from escalating into deadly ones, says Inspector General Earl Devaney. He released his report late last month. Found shoddy conditions at 13 schools that investigators spot checked among more than 180 the agency runs for American Indian children on tribal reservations. That's a nice touch. Couldn't you get any blankets while you're at it? Nearly 60 dams managed by Interior were found to be at high risk of giving way or overflowing. Well, that's easy. Just call in the Corps of Engineers. They can. Interior employees themselves were often at greatest risk. Staff members of the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Geological Survey continued to work in a condemned fish hatchery near Jackson, Wyoming, until the auditors warned the secretaries of Interior's office last year. The building had been closed to the public for 7 years because of dangerous structural flaws, but employees continued to use some of the facilities to restock endangered trout. Interior Department employees' accident rates are among the highest in the federal government. The audit says the agency has far too few safety employees for its mission and size. The Secretary of Interior says he's made a personal commitment to his employees to improve health and safety agency-wide. The auditors had heightened concerns about three problems they noticed early on: the Wawona Tunnel in Yosemite, the schools on the Indian reservations, and the fish hatchery. In the middle of the audit, they urged the secretary, Dirk Kempthorne, to address them quickly. "I am alarmed at the potential for a catastrophic event of massive and deadly proportions in the tunnel at Yosemite," one Park Service official wrote anonymously in a safety survey. Auditors also determined that Yellowstone's water systems are significantly deteriorating and that the now-closed Dinosaur National Monument was literally falling apart atop shifting soil in Colorado, putting irreplaceable fossils at risk. At Grand Teton, an office headquarters building located on an earthquake fault is not built to code for earthquake protection. The Bureau of Indian Affairs inspected all tribal schools reviewed in the audit and began making lists of repairs. Your Inspector General at work, ladies and gentlemen. This is a special edition of the show. Although, as I say, I'm in New Orleans, go Hornets. The main body of this show is going to be about Los Angeles, and specifically one particular person in Los Angeles who has just passed away and who got a little obituary, but the passing wasn't widely noticed, I don't think. Although he had a profound effect on me when I was growing up, and I wanted to share some of that with you today. His name was Brian Kluwer, and for about four decades, he had a radio show in Los Angeles called Cynic's Choice. The title of the show doesn't give you really much clue of what he did. What he did was to introduce that segment of Los Angeles that might have been listening to him to the great world of British comedy. And he actually succeeded in his career in being on more radio stations in Los Angeles than I have, which is saying something. He moved this show basically about every 6 months as stations decided, well, that's too cranky, that's too weird, that's too out of format. And every once in a while, I'd realize where he'd move to and catch up with the show. But it was during the time I was growing up that it just had the most profound influence on me, because it was this other world of comedy that Brian Kluwer, a Brit himself, he had his day job was he had a little shop first in the Ambassador Hotel, which you could go see if the city hadn't colluded in its destruction, because it was historic. Why would you want that around that place, the Ambassador Hotel? And then he moved it out to Santa Monica, just because I guess he thought the homeless people had money and a taste for British comedy. But he had the shop was not just stocked with British comedy records and later videos. It was stocked, and I think this was its mainstay, with the foods that expatriate Brits in Los Angeles missed. For example, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if you know this, the Heinz baked beans that they sell in Britain are not the same as the Heinz baked beans that they sell in the United States. And a guy builds a business around that. Anyway, one day a week he'd come in and play most amazing British comedy on record, because in those days it was put on record. And I'm going to share some of it with you today, starting with where it should start, starting with Peter Sellers.
I wasn't keen on the assignment when my editor first handed it to me. Do a feature on Major Rafe Ralph. There's been so many stories about Major Ralph, the colorful horse dealer who'd gone into the business of managing rock and roll stars. I mean, he personally discovered such disc names as Lenny Bronze, Clint Thigh, Matt Lust, and such vocal groups as the Fleshpots, the Muckrakers. There were always five or six up-and-coming rock stars living with him in his luxury flat in Mount Street, so it was naturally there I went to get my interview.
These rock and roll boys are big business now.
But it must be so very different going from horse trading to rock and roll singers.
Well, of course it is. I mean, horses have got a better ear for music. You ever seen a rock and roll singer, Miss Lisbon? I mean, have you ever seen one up close?
Well, no, I'm mostly on book reviewing.
Well, a good specimen. He's about 17 or 18 years old. About 5'10", fully extended, sagging to about 5'4" in the singing position. Points to look for are the forehead. Shouldn't be more than about 1/2 inch of that. Plenty of mouth. The lower lip permanently slack and wherever possible fallen arches. They save a lot of trouble in mid-career, you know.
I suppose a nice musical singing voice is what you look out for as well. Is that right?
I do, yes. First sign of that and out he goes. What?
To me, the most fascinating part is that you always house 5 or 6 of these rock and roll stars in your own home.
Well, it's not all that eccentric. I mean, some of them can be house-trained with a little patience. Would you like to see one? Get one for you.
Major, some rotten hands pinch the strings of my guitar, look.
You've got the guitar on back to front. How many times must I tell you the whole point's away from you?
So much to learn, so little time.
And you should know better than to enter this part of the flat. It's in your contract. Where the carpet begins, you halt. Now, which one are you, anyway?
I'm Cyril Rambo.
Not your real name, the name I gave you. For heaven's sake, I've embroidered on your T-shirt for you. Look there, man. Look there, there. Between the sunset and the coconut palms.
I'm Twit Conway.
I'll try and remember it in future. Come over here now. Come over here and meet this... Come on, faster, faster, faster!
Can't walk any faster. These crepe soles, I'm so off the ground.
Steady yourself against a wall. What have you done to your blue jeans?
I've had to cut the knees up, Major. I had to cut them out. They were so tight, my kneecaps went all green.
Well, you're not going on television looking like that. You just borrow my fountain pen and ink in where the flesh shows. I want you to meet this lady sitting in the armchair. She's from a newspaper.
Hello, I'm a journalist. My name is Nancy Lisbon. I should so much like to do a story on you. I mean, you as a person. Tell me, what does it feel like to suddenly find yourself a teenage idol?
Well, it don't make much difference, really. I mean, I was idle before I was a teenager.
The lad is trying to say, Miss Lisbon, is that success has not spoiled him. He is still the same twit he always was. Right, lad?
That's what I should have said, yeah.
Of course it's what you should have said. Now, don't be nervous, lad. Just remember our lessons on how to answer press questions. Just bear in mind what you've been told to say.
Well, Twit, do you want to stay a rock and roll singer all your life? I mean, what is your ultimate ambition?
We are just good friends.
That is the answer to another question. Remember, the answer to this one is, I want to become an all-round.
Oh, yeah. I want to become an all-round.
Entertainer.
Entertainer, yeah. My dream is one day to play Old Vic in Shakespeare.
Oh, how sweet. You're fond of Shakespeare? Are you fond of Shakespeare?
We are just good friends.
He's rather shy still. Just a sweet, lovable lad. Natural, fun-loving, and a good son to his own mother and father. Tell Miss Lisbon how you look after your parents, Conway.
Who? Huh?
Your parents, your mother and father.
Oh, yeah. Now that I've got some money, I've been able to move my old mum and dad into a small house.
I bet they're delighted.
No, they ain't. They was in a big house. It was the Major's idea. You see, he said, you're a victim and I'll flog the...
Yes, I think Miss Lisbon has probably had enough. Okay. Now, well, Conway, back you go to your quarters. Tell Vince and Donnie I'll be along very soon for some hip-twitching practice.
All right, sir. Well, goodbye, Miss Lisbon.
Goodbye, Twit. And if you think of anything further, here's my card. I think I'd better be getting along too, Major.
Right, well, I'll see you to the front door. I trust, Miss Lisbon, you won't go and write one of those nasty, lurid stories about my kids. I mean, you saw Conway for yourself. He's just as normal and well-balanced as any other 17-year-old ex-plasterer's mate suddenly earning 1,000 quid a week.
Yes, it has made me think.
And don't you go making me out to be a sort of profiteering Svengali, will you? I mean, these boys stay here willingly, because to them I'm almost a second father. We enjoy a very beautiful relationship. Beautiful, Miss Lisbon, because it is based on trust, mutual trust.
It's a very rare quality in this modern world, Major.
It is indeed, yes. Don't touch the doorknob. It's got 2,000 volts running through it. Well, good night, Miss Lisbon.
Good night, Major.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the
week. We're so sorry.
Well, a Christian pastor has apologized for a sermon. No, it's not who you think. It's been a month since the Reverend Richard Mark Lee apologized for what he said was the arrogant, judgmental attitude the Christian church has displayed over the years. During that time, he's fielded calls from Good Morning America producers who considered having him on their show. Hey, babe, I know the feeling. It's been interesting, said Lee, the senior pastor at Sugar Hill First Baptist, and most of what we've heard has been very positive. In his March 30th apology sermon, he said he was sorry to women who have had abortions, gays, and anyone else the church might have hurt, judged, and dismissed. Lee apologized personally for having picketed an abortion clinic and for having laughed at jokes deriding gay people. So he wasn't apologizing for a sermon, he was apologizing in a sermon. Just those damn prepositions. Ohio Attorney General Mark Dan said this week he had an affair with an employee and three aides were forced out of their jobs in a scandal over sexual harassment allegations. It's Ohio. Who knew? Dan, a Democrat who was often compared to Elliot Spitzer, said he will not resign even after an investigation scolded his conduct and Republicans called for him to step down. Two women accused one of Dan's top aides of making unwanted advances and vulgar remarks. Dan would not identify the employee involved in the affair, which he called consensual, and said it came during a difficult time in his marriage. He apologized to his wife and three children for the pain and embarrassment. Deadline New Orleans, Jim Benazzani, the former special agent in charge of the FBI's Louisiana operations, apologized to his staff this week for his public flirtation with political office, mentioned on his broadcast last week, that brought his ouster, and then told them he would spend 2 weeks mulling his options. Another apology, another nutty morning team on radio. You know, when people say, what role does radio play in the modern digital universe? I say, just listen in the morning. Woody and Wilcox, who are on the air in Alaska, had a joke on the air. You're not an Alaskan unless you've made love to the Yukon River and peed in a native woman. You see, the original version of the joke is you're not an Alaskan unless you've made love to a native woman and peed in the Yukon River, and they did the old switcheroo, which publicly revealed an attitude Alaska natives face all too often, says Representative Mary Nelson, a Democrat of Bethel, Alaska. The positive thing about this is it was on the airwaves, not a joke between two people, she says, not uttered under someone's breath, but in the light of day where it could be heard. Well, or not, depending on the ratings. Radio hosts and the station's manager, Gary Donovan, have apologized on the station's webpage. In a possibly related matter, Western Australian opposition leader Troy Buswell had to hold back tears while acknowledging offensive behavior towards a female colleague. He refused to be drawn on an allegation that he sniffed the chair of a female staffer in late 2005. On 13 occasions, he described the allegation as an unsubstantiated rumor, but this week he admitted the allegation was true. In an emotionally charged press conference, had to take a break when tears started welling in his eyes. He conceded that his behavior before becoming leader had sometimes been highly offensive, but said he is committed to changing. There's no question that that's inappropriate behavior. Nobody questions that. And Troy understands that himself, says the deputy leader of the Liberal Party, vouching for the chair sniffer. Miley Cyrus issued a statement exclusively to People magazine, apologizing for a series of playfully provocative photos that circulated on the internet last week, as well as those from a racy, as yet unreleased Vanity Fair photo shoot in which she appears to be nude. The singer, 15, tells People, "My goal in my music and my acting is always to make people happy. For Vanity Fair, I was honored and thrilled to work with Annie Leibovitz. I took part in a photo shoot that was supposed to be artistic, and now, seeing the photographs and reading the story, I feel so embarrassed." Dateline San Diego, Timothy Fuzzy Timms, a 45-year-old member of the Hells Angels, stood up for his First Amendment right to freedom of expression this week. He refused to take off a black leather vest with the motorcycle club's death head insignia when he reported for jury duty. His stance got him booted from the San Diego Superior Court's Hall of Justice because the judge had earlier ordered two defendants not to wear Hells Angels wardrobe to their trial. "It's a misunderstanding of the order by court security," said a court spokeswoman. The representatives of the Superior Court and the Sheriff's Department apologized to Timms and to club member Mick Rush for the misunderstanding. And back to Australia for our final apology. Shoalhaven, a little town in Australia. Mayor is Greg Watson. Made some remarks at a public meeting. He says the remarks have been misconstrued. He made the remarks in relationship to the discounted sell-off of public land, which the council was proposing, and raised some opposition to the discounted pricing of the land. And his response was, quote, "Why don't you jack the price up? Why don't you be a good Jew? Why don't you screw the last dollar out of it like public enterprise would?" he said at the meeting. And then one of the residents at the meeting had a reaction. Australia's ABC Radio picks up the story.
"Yeah, I came up to him and I said to him, did you make some comments about Jews during your speech? And he said, no, I didn't. And then it was sort of, yes, you did, no, you didn't sort of thing. And after a while, I said, look, you did say that, and I found that really, really offensive, you know, upsetting. And after a while, he says, oh, well, you know, maybe I did. I might have been a slip of the tongue. Yeah, well, actually, yes, I did say it. Sorry. He said, if I've offended you, I'm sorry. At which point I said, that's not really enough. I mean, the place was still half full. And I said, look, I would like you to make a public apology. There's all these people here. Most of whom I'd never seen before, to be honest. But I don't know who, you know, what background those people had. I only knew three or four people in the room. And I just said, look, just saying sorry to me isn't enough. I want you to make a public apology. And he just said no.
The mayor admits he made the remarks, but says they've been taken out of context. I apologised to the gentleman concerned when he expressed concern about it later on, but it's a phrase which is in common use by wife who is Jewish at home, and there was no offence intended. If anyone took offence, I apologise. I've explained to you the context of it was in relation to creating jobs, and it was not intended as an offensive remark. The remark could be taken as praise. It could be taken as praise.
Could be taken as praise. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. This is Le Show remembering Los Angeles radio personality Brian Kluwer, who introduced at least me, and I think some others in the Southern California area, to the world of British comedy. Talents such as Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
Two's up, Dad. Thanks very much, Pete.
Nothing like a nice cup of tea.
Nothing like a nice cup of tea, is there, Pete?
Nothing like it, Dad.
What's that you're reading, Pete?
Oh, this is a wonderful book, Dad. It's steeped in history. It's Burke's Peerages.
Burke's Peerages, what's that, Pete?
Well, it's a brilliant idea. It's a book which contains the names of the 20,000 most noble people in the realm.
Who'd want to read that, Pete?
Well, the 20,000 most noble people in the world, for a start. It's a superb idea. It all dates back to the 18th century, Dad, the age of reason, when, of course, the clever called reigned supreme.
Yeah.
And there was this Burke, you see.
What was his...
There was this Burke.
What was his name, Pete?
Burke. Burke was his name.
Burke?
He was Burke, yeah. A high fluting Burke's, one of the great Sussex Burke's.
Yeah.
And he was wandering about in his palatial parkland, you see, Dad, on a fine 18th century summer morning.
Yeah.
A lovely scene, as you can well imagine, the sun dappling through the trees.
Caught one of his beautiful peacocks, flaunting its exotic feathers in the sunlight.
Precisely. emitting the strange bird-like cry which sometimes comes from them. Very similar to the noise you just admitted. Right. And suddenly...
Play it cool, boy.
No, suddenly it come to him.
What come to him, the peacock?
No, this wonderful concept come to him. He thought, why don't I get hold of the names of the 20,000 most noble people in the realm and flog it for £2 a time? He made a fortune out of it.
Of course he did, Pip. I could do exactly the same thing, though, couldn't I? I could go up Barron Road and knock on every door, say, excuse me, Mrs. Taylor, I wonder if you'd give me your name and I'll put it in a book and flog it back to you.
You'd do very well, the Barron Road Gazette.
Yeah.
Could do very nicely with that sort of thing.
Of course you could. Clean up, boy.
Of course, the whole business of ancestry is extremely fascinating. I've been into my past, you know.
Really?
Yes, I've traced myself back at Somerset House. And do you know, in primordial times, my great-great-great-great-grandfather come over with the Druids.
What, the Druids of Lymington Crescent?
Yes, George and... George and Phoebe's ancestors.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's marvellous, isn't it? I had a bit of trouble. I went to Somerset House one morning. It was a nice morning. I thought, you know, go along to Somerset House.
Why not pop
you
down,
know,
yes.
Pop down and
have
a look at the birth certificate, you know. Makes a change, doesn't it?
Of course it does, Dad.
I went down there. I said to the gentleman behind the counter, can I have a look at my birth certificate?
Yeah.
And so he got it out, and I had a look, and it said, it had my mother's name down there, but where my father's name was supposed to be, there wasn't nothing there. So, you know, I thought to myself, funny, you know. Mother's name here, father's name not there, you know, Fanny.
Mother, no father, birth certificate.
Exactly,
you
how does she
need the
do
two
it?
Of them, Fanny.
Fanny,
yeah, very
yes,
peculiar.
Very peculiar. So I taxed my mother on this point, but she was very evasive about it.
Well, it's probably a foggy evening, wasn't it, that day? But the wonderful thing about it, the ancestry business, is, you know, we've all got a bit of noble blood in our veins.
Yeah, it's the best place for it, isn't it, Pete?
Well, it's a wonderful place for blood, Dad.
Let's keep it that way, Pete.
Let's keep it that way in this nuclear age when all the whole hydrogen hovers over us all. Exactly.
Exactly, Pete.
And do you know that we're all in line for succession to the throne?
Really?
Yes, if 48,200,701 people died, I'd be queen.
Where would I come in that, Pete?
I think 3/4 of the world has to pass away before you get it.
But, What would you do if you were Queen, Pete?
Well, I'd turn a job down. I wouldn't do it.
Really?
Too much like hard work, if you ask me.
No, I'd rather like it, you know. I'll tell you what I'd do. I'd give the MBE to Mrs. Woolley, and I'd give Aunt Dolly the Order of the Garter for services rendered to humanity.
Yeah. Your Aunt Dolly could do with a bit of decoration, couldn't she?
This is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. From the BBC, police in southern China have discovered a factory manufacturing flags that say Free Tibet. The factory in Guangdong had been completing overseas orders for the flag of the Tibetan government in exile. Workers said they thought they were just making colorful flags and did not realize their meaning. Then some of them saw TV images of protesters holding the emblem and they alerted the authorities. This is according to Hong Kong's Ming Pao newspaper. The factory owner reportedly told police the emblems had been ordered from outside China. He did not know that they stood for an independent Tibet. Workers who had grown suspicious checked the meaning of the flag by going online. See, China will let you do that. Thousands of the flags had already been packed for shipping. police believe some may already have been sent overseas and could appear in Hong Kong during the Olympic torch relay protests coming up. Which reminds me, I've often wondered if you just interviewed Chinese workers and asked them what any of the stuff they're making is for or means, they might well be bewildered. Or maybe not. And from the Telegraph newspaper in England, more than one in four honeybee colonies didn't survive the winter in Britain. Beekeepers want the government to stop the disaster. Beekeepers expect to lose a proportion of their bees every year, but far bigger losses than expected have been reported across the United Kingdom. Inspectors from the National Bee Unit found 26% of the colonies dead compared to 18% last year. The British Beekeepers Association has been warning the British government that bee numbers have been falling dramatically and that a potential economic and ecological disaster was unfolding. The latest figures will renew fears that the mysterious colony collapse disorder, CCD, which has decimated bee colonies in the United States, may now be affecting British bees. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. This is Le Show saluting the British comedy that formed an audio part of my childhood, thanks to Los Angeles radio host Brian Kluwer. And this was the comedy that was listened to and watched later on in Britain, I'm reliably informed, by the current generation that we're all much more familiar with, I think, Monty Python, Ricky Gervais. Those folks grew up listening to the Goon shows, which I'm not going to play because I've never understood them. I mean, I heard people laughing as I was listening to them as a kid, and I just went, why? But they were fast-moving and great characters. I just didn't understand why people were laughing. But and you may have the same feeling about these, but an interesting fact about the material I'm featuring today, which was as close as I can come to recapturing the original generation of British humor featured by Brian Kluwer on his radio show, his long-lived radio show in Los Angeles, is a strange thing these three pieces and many more have in common. Both the Peter Sellers and the Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and the one I'm going to feature next, Flanders and Swann, who were mainly a musical comedy act. They wrote and performed funny songs, but not all the material was musical. All three acts were produced by the same man, and that fact was pretty much the explanation of why a British rock and roll band, skittish about going into the recording studio for a major record company, agreed to let this guy produce their records. The band, of course, was the Beatles. The man was George Martin, and here are Flanders and Swann.
Wimbledon, June, ladies singles, third round. Ball boys are bounding all over the ground. Play started at 2 and we're still on the rack. It's 4:45 and they've hardly begun. A perfect defense meets a perfect attack. Miss L. Hammerfest meets Miss J. Hunter Dunn. Game to Miss Hunter Dunn. Miss Hammerfest leads by 2-1 in the third set, having won the first by 18-16, lost the second 25-27. I never liked tennis. Damn silly name of the game with its volleys and lubs and all that. The first time I umpired was June 36. I didn't think much of it then. Just rather fancied myself in the hat. Since when, I have umpired again and again and again. And year after year, as I've sat on court after court, I've been struck by the thought, they are bashing a ball with the gut of a cat. What a sport. You may think it's tedious, seen from down there. It's ludicrous, seen from above. 15, love, keeping my eye firmly fixed on the ball, hoping the linesman will know what to call. 15, all, as each long, drawn-out point puts my neck out of joint, What a job, set after set. Oh, the relief when you get the occasional lob. Ah. Till they smash it. Oh, dash it. 30, 15. What does it all mean? 40, 15. Why 30, 15? Why 40, 15? What have I been said? I just said 1-0, 2-0, 3-0 in game. Do just the same. Some of the older debenture holders be bound to get shirty. 40, 30. Now the spectators are trickling out. There's thunder about. With luck, it'll rain. That ought to reduce. Deuce! Half of me bored. Net cord. The other half nervous. First service. Wish it were dinner. Thank God a winner. Advantage, Miss Hammerfest. Bonk. Bink. Bonk. Bink. Drives you to drink. Sitting up here, I'm obsessed with the fear of getting it wrong. Everyone else will be going bonk, bink. I shall be going bink, bonk. Oh, do get it over with. What is the use? Well, we're back again. Deuce! Wimbledon, June, ladies singles, third round. Groundsmen are asked, how's the state of the ground? Players are photographed, jumping the nets. Here sits a figure one always forgets. The umpire, upon whom the sun never sets.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm. Don't you think?
Soft, listen to the warm.
Dead zones containing too little oxygen for fish to breathe are growing as global temperatures increase. According to New Scientist, warmer water dissolves less oxygen. I didn't know that. So as temperatures rise, oxygen vanishes from the oceans. Marine biologists are warning that if dead zones continue expanding, oceanic deserts could massively deplete marine life and fish stocks. On the other hand, it'd be a great place to build some casinos. Recovery of the ozone hole above Antarctica could warm the Antarctic and cause more ice to melt in coming decades, researchers have told Nature. As the ozone hole heals, wind patterns that shield the interior of the polar region from warm air may break down, causing warming in the Antarctic as well as warmer and drier conditions in Australia, mate. Despite global temperatures rising, the interior of Antarctica has experienced a unique cooling trend during its summer and autumn over the last few decades. Scientists attribute this cooling to the hole in the ozone layer, which alters atmospheric circulation patterns and strengthens the westerly winds that swirl around the continent. Those winds have isolated the Antarctic interior from the warming patterns seen on the continent's peninsula and throughout the rest of the world. So you fix it, you screw it up. The warming of the Antarctic may have been delayed because of the ozone hole, says atmospheric scientist Judith Perlwitz. But thanks to the Montreal Protocol that banned the release of ozone-depleting substances, most scientists agree the ozone hole has probably reached its largest and that ozone levels will recover by the end of the century. You try to do something good for the Antarctic. Parts of North America and Europe may cool naturally over the next decade, as shifting ocean currents temporarily blunt the global warming effect caused by mankind, according to Germany's Leibniz Institute of Marine Sciences. Average temperatures in California and France may drop over the next 10 years, influenced by colder flows in the North Atlantic, said this report. Temperatures worldwide may stabilize in the period. The study was based on sea surface temperatures of currents that move heat around the world and vary from decade to decade. This regional cooling effect may temporarily neutralize the long-term warming, says Richard Wood, a research scientist in the UK's Meteorological Office. Those natural climate variations could be stronger than the global warming trend over the next 10-year period, Wood said. Without knowing that, you might erroneously think there's no global warming going on. And climate change is a growing risk to older properties in and southern British cities, including London, and should inform the decision-making of investors in property, according to one of Britain's biggest pension fund managers. So don't buy property in London. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. How are things going in Iraq? Well, you know that the Congress has begun making noises about now that the oil prices have moved sky high, you know, like we were promised they were before the war, that maybe the Iraqi government should shoulder more of its financial share of the reconstruction and the other thing, the war thing. Well, here's the reaction of Abdul Basit, the head of Iraq's Supreme Board of Audit, an independent body that oversees Iraqi government spending. Quote, America has hardly even begun to repay its debt to Iraq. This is an immoral request because we didn't ask them to come to Iraq, and before they came in 2003, we didn't have all these needs. Unquote. How's the war on terror going? Well, let's ask the State Department, won't we? The U.S. State Department has just released its 2007 report on terrorism. Al-Qaeda remains the biggest threat to the United States and its allies, but using the tribal areas of Pakistan, who knew that? It has rebuilt some of its pre-September 11th capabilities, and its top leadership, especially Ayman al-Zawahiri, has regained some of its control over the group's operations worldwide. The number of what the report had identified as terrorist attacks worldwide fell slightly in 2007, but the number of people killed in the attacks rose, a small percentage, which suggests that people around the world are getting increasingly efficient at killing other people, as an official from the National Counterterrorism Center says. One factor contributing to the increased lethality of the attacks, increased use of backpacks by suicide bombers that are easier to sneak into crowded areas. There was a 50% increase in suicide attacks worldwide over the previous year. Incidents fell slightly in Iraq, but still accounted for 45% of all attacks and 60% of all terrorism fatalities worldwide in 2007. Pakistan saw a 100% increase in attacks. Injuries and fatalities in our friend quadrupled. There was a 16% increase in terrorist attacks in Afghanistan. Well over 50% of those killed or injured were Muslims. 2,400 were children. War on terror, ladies and gentlemen. Mission accomplished. And some Los Angeles dog trainer corrections. Because, you know, now that the paper's under new ownership, I'm sure things have gotten much better on the accuracy level. A review in Monday's calendar section of Prince's performance at the Coachella Valley Music Festival said that Sheena Easton performed with him on I Feel For You. It was Chaka Khan who sang with him. The review also said that Shelby J sang a cover version of Sarah McLachlan's Angel. That performance was by Ledisi. An article in Friday's Section A on Turkish mediation efforts said Israel's border with Syria had been quiet since the 1967 Middle East War. In fact, Israel and Syrian troops battled in the Golan Heights during the 1973 war between Israel and its neighbors. An article in Monday's health section about the hallucinogenic herb Salvia divinorum referred to a slogan for the use of psychedelic drugs as, quote, turn on and tune out, unquote. The actual slogan coined by Timothy Leary was tune on, turn on, tune in, and drop out. Well, that's just because it's kids running the paper now. And, speaking of drugs, the obituary of Albert Hoffman, the Swiss chemist who discovered LSD in Wednesday's California section of the Los Angeles Dog Trainer, said he was survived by his wife, Anita. She died in December. The story also referred to peyote mushrooms. Peyote is a cactus. Los Angeles Dog Trainer corrections, ladies and gentlemen, for you. Now, once again, Peter Sellers, and this was the piece that first alerted to me to what an amazing American accent at least one British comedian could do. The meta joke in all of this is that the name of the community being profiled in this pseudo documentary is Balham, as it's pronounced in Britain, Balham, and it's like Downey, I guess, more than any place else. But it gets transformed.
Balham, gateway to the south. We enter Balham through the verdant grasslands of Battersea Park, and at once we are aware that here is a land of happy, contented people who go about their daily tasks in truly democratic spirit. This is busy High Street, focal point of the town's activity. Note the quaint old stores whose frontage is covered with hand-painted inscriptions. Every one a rare example of native Balham art. Let us read some of them as our camera travels past.
Cooking apples, choice eaters.
A song to remember at the Tandemount Cinema.
A suit to remember at Montague Moss.
Promotions conducted with decorum and taste.
Friday night, bring your own paper. Rally Thursday, Berkeley Square. Viscountess Lewisham and Mrs. Gerald Legg. Up the ruling classes.
This shows the manifold activities of Balham's thriving community. But in quiet corners, we still find examples of the exquisite workmanship that Balham craftsmen have made world famous. Toothbrush holesmanship.
On my forge, I carve the little holes in the top of toothbrushes. It is exciting work, and my forefathers have been engaged upon it since 1957. The little holes in the top are put in manually, or in other words, once a year. I recently had the honor of demonstrating my craft before the owner of Ice. He stopped by one day for a couple of words. I did not understand either of them.
So much for Balham's industries. Now let us see a little more of the town. Here is the great park covering nearly half an acre. This is where the children traditionally meet by the limpid waters of the old drinking fountain. A drinking fountain that has for countless years across the vast aeons of time given untold pleasure to man, woman, and child. Beside this fountain, donated by able counselor Quills as long ago as 1928, the little ones sit around a trim nursemaid and listen spellbound and enchanted as she reads them a story.
With one bound, he was by her side. Nora felt his hot breath on her cheek as he ripped the thin silk from...
We are now entering Old Balham. Time has passed by this remote corner. So shall we. But Balham is not neglecting the cultural side. This is Eugene Quills, whose weekly recitals are attended by a vast concord of people. He has never had a lesson in his life. Such is the enthusiasm of Balham's music lovers that they are subscribing to a fund to send Eugene to Italy or Vienna or anywhere. Night falls on Balham. From Quill's Folly, Balham's famous beauty spot, which stands nearly 10 feet above sea level, the town is spread below us in a fairyland of glittering lights, changing all the time. Green, amber, red, red and amber, and back to green. The nightlife is awakening. The El Morocco Tea Room.
Hi, miss.
Yes, what you want?
Pilchards.
They're off, dear.
Baked beans?
Off.
Oh, meatloaf salad?
That's off, too.
Pot of tea?
No tea, dear.
Well, just milk, then.
Milk's off.
Roll and butter, then?
No butter, dear.
Oh, just a roll.
Only bread, love.
I might have just as well have stayed at home.
Well, I don't know. It does you good to have a fling occasionally.
And so the long night draws on. The last stragglers make their way home, and the lights go out one by one as dawn approaches and the bell of St. Quill's Parish Church tolls 10 o'clock. Balham sleeps. And so we say farewell to this historic borough with many pleasant memories and the words of C. Quill Smith, Balham's own bard, burning in our ears.
Broad-bosomed, bold, becalmed, benign, lies Balham, four square on the northern line. Matched by no marvel save in eastern scene, a rose-red city, half as gold as green. by country churchyard, ferny fen and muir, what quills mute, inglorious, lies buried here? Oh, stands the church clock at 10 to 3, and is there honey still for tea?
Honey's off, dear.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show with Dudley Moore doing his version of the Colonel Bogey March. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz on the mighty 104 in Berlin on Sirius and XM satellite radios. Available via the internet at two different locations on your computer whenever you want them. It, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available as a free download at www.audible.com/LeShow and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like us being as funny as the Brits if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Uh-huh. I forgot about Larry the Cable Guy. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, and Chicago desks for help in today's broadcast, and as always to Pam Halstead. The website where you can find the playlist for these broadcasts and the email address for the host is harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.